regardless of what radical or progressive movement you're a part of, our movements have faced a similar enemy. That's basically the COINTELPRO type tactics that have been pervaded by the FBI, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and our catch-all favorite joint terrorism task forces, which are basically entities of law enforcement made up of federal, state, and local law enforcement that is singularly focused on a particular movement or a particular group of individuals, primarily based on their political ideologies. So the fervor with which the FBI attempts to undermine and destroy these popular movements, you know, those who depart from the capitalist norm, has been extensive throughout history, and it appears generally to be proportional to the strength and promise of the movement that's being targeted. So during the 1960s, the government stated its goal, quote, and just so you know, I'm going to do a lot of quoting, so I have notes here. But the goal in the 1960s was to expose, disrupt, misdirect, or otherwise neutralize the enemies of the state. Black nationalists was the label in 1968 that J. Edgar Hoover, who was an FBI head honcho, sent a memo out to his field offices regarding the, quote, Black Nationalist Hate Groups program. And he said, quote, to prevent the coalition of militant Black nationalist groups, to prevent the rise of a messiah who could unify and electrify the militant Black nationalist movement, and examples of that are, you know, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, to prevent violence on the part of Black nationalist groups, to prevent militant Black nationalist groups and leaders from gaining respectability, and to prevent the long-range growth of militant Black nationalist organizations, especially among youth. And these were not people who were getting arrested for crimes. Civil rights and religious groups were being branded with these labels as well, you know, basically just to discredit them and make it so that they would not gain in numbers or popularity. So in June of 1970, there was a top secret report that was sent out regarding the Black Panther Party and the government targeting the Black Panthers. And this outrageous report states, the most active and dangerous Black extremist group in the U.S. Is the Black Panther Party. Its hardcore members were estimated at about 800 across the entire nation. But a recent poll indicates that approximately 25% of the Black population has a great respect for the Black Panther Party, including 43% of Blacks under 21. Because of the potential of the Black Panther Party, counterintelligence operations were carried out to ensure it did not succeed in organizing as a substantial social or political tool. So in the end, there's kind of a famous African studies professor named James Turner, Dr. James Turner, and he basically did an assessment, summed up everything that happened during this era by saying serious long-term consequences for Black Americans occurred as a result of this targeting. They had created in Blacks a sense of depression and hopelessness. He is further quoted by saying, the FBI set out to break the momentum developed in Black communities in the late 50s and early 60s. We needed to put together organizational mechanisms to deliver services, but instead our ability to influence things that happened to us internally and externally was killed. The lack of confidence and paranoia stimulated amongst Black people by these actions is now just beginning to fade in the 2000s. So for those of you aligned with environmental, animal, or anarchist leanings, you may be seeing some resemblances already. You know thy history. If you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. And part of our theme tonight is, you know, cross-movements and cross-generational discussions. You know, if we can't learn from what has gone before us, we're bound to repeat those those efforts. So climate change, poisoned water, the air, the soil, horrific, unnecessary animal experimentations, and fur farms that service lewdly rich individuals have become increasingly important in the public dialogue. The momentum for these movements and the issues that they are discussing is growing and has been growing in the last decade or two. And so it's not surprising that they soon also became a target. I think that the government doesn't want our movements to be scrutinizing their actions against the backdrop of historical context. It's exactly this reason that all activists must know and understand their history. So one easy example that I've found in doing this comparison, under Bush Incorporated, the era of lists came to be. You know, whether and this is a very classic COINTELPRO tactic, watch lists, terrorist lists, the VCOG, you know, violent gang affiliation lists, NSA, you know, this alphabet soup of lists, which basically are letting us know that they are watching. And that's nothing new. In the late 1960s and 70s, while the government was targeting black extremists instead of animal rights extremists or eco-terrorists, they also targeted key activists with the use of a list. At that time, it was called the National Security Index. Not so different from what we've got going on right now. And another example of history just repeating itself. Right now, many people are in fear of joint terrorism task forces, which is just a replay, once again, of these criminal conspiracy sections that occurred in the 1960s, especially like in the LAPD. The local and federal cops were targeting political revolutionaries during that time, and they had a name, you know, that they used as well for their joint terrorism task forces. So in the aftermath of the L.A. Black Panther raids, which maybe Claude will touch on a little bit, the cops came in with enormous firepower to assassinate Geronimo Pratt. It was learned later that the number three man in the L.A. Black Panthers, Melvin Cotton Smith, was an infiltrator and a provocateur who provided the cops with floor plans, sleeping arrangements, and a bunch of other information prior to the raid. When the Panthers were prosecuted in the aftermath of this with the assistance of the infiltrator, after 11 days of jury deliberation, they were all acquitted of all charges, except for like a minor illegal weapons charge. But interestingly, in 1985, 15 years later, Smith totally recanted his allegations against Geronimo Pratt, stating that the former Panther leader had been framed by the FBI. 15 years later, you know, the truth actually comes out. And after serving 27 years in prison, Geronimo Gijaga Pratt was finally released from prison and his wrongful conviction overturned. So during the Green Scare, what I've been working on for the last 5 years, we've been demanding FOIA documents regarding investigations, infiltrations, and other COINTELPRO activities that we're hearing from our clients are happening even today. And of course, the feds once again claim no records exist, you know, that we're all paranoid that this isn't going on. But if history is any lesson, the feds are a bunch of liars. And if you look at some of the old FBI counterintelligence-related memos going back to the 1960s, you know, you can learn a lot because you know that the same stuff is certainly going on right now. They're not very creative. They just keep, you know, changing the names and replaying the same rules. So here's one of those memos. Successful prosecution is the best deterrent to such unlawful activities as dissident political organizing. Big crime. Intensive investigations of key activists are logically expected to result in prosecutions under substantive violation within the Bureau's jurisdiction. Now you know why I think that we need more hardcore criminal defense lawyers out there in the activist world. There are a lot of them from the older generations that we're very thankful to have around, because many of them lived through this era and are now mentoring us. And when, you know, we request documents and get no's back, they laugh heartily and say, of course they exist, ha ha ha. And so just when we think we're crazy and paranoid, you know, some of these old school criminal defense lawyers actually can give us these stories because they worked through them themselves. An example of how that cross-generational cooperation is really essential to make us as powerful as possible. So student protesters, or as the FBI described them, quote, the movement of rebellious youth known as the New Left, which involved a substantial number of college students, the government felt that they were having a serious impact on contemporary society with a potential to cause serious domestic strife. The New Left has revolutionary aims and has attempted to infiltrate and radicalize labor, and after failing to subvert and control the mass media, has established a large network of underground publications which serve the dual purpose of an internal communication network and an external propaganda organ. So for any of you that read Bite Back, The Journal, or any of those subversive underground newspapers, you know, at one point that was cause for federal investigation and prosecution of students. And of course, the American Indian movement, which was arguably the most hopeful vehicle for indigenous pride and self-determination, was also basically destroyed as a force to be reckoned with by the FBI and COINTELPRO. Dennis Banks, who's one of the longtime AIM leaders, probably said it best by saying, "The FBI's tactics eventually proved successful in a peculiar sort of way. It's remarkable under the circumstances and a real testament to the inner strength of the traditional Ogallalas that the feds were never really able to divide them from us, to have the traditionals denouncing us or working against us. But in the end, the sort of pressure the FBI put on the people on the reservation, particularly the old people, it just wore them down. A kind of fatigue set in. With the firefight that happened at Ogallala and all the things that happened after that, it was easy to see we weren't going to win by direct confrontation. So the traditionals asked us to disengage to try and take some of the heaviest pressure off. And out of respect, we had no choice but to honor those wishes. And that was the end of AIM, at least in the way it had been up until then. The resistance is still there, of course, and the struggle goes on, but the movement itself kind of disappeared." And lest we think that the environmental movement or the animal rights movement has escaped government's attempts to murder our fellow activists, let's recall the case of the attempted murder of two extremely popular activists fighting to stop clear-cutting of old-growth redwood forests, Earth First leaders Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney. During what might be considered a historic moment of unprecedented popularity and growth within the forest preservation movement, it was called Redwood Summer, thousands of people convened for a bunch of civil disobedience marches and rallies. There were movie stars, rock stars, you know, all sorts of people came. And Judy was a staunch labor organizer as well as an environmentalist, and she's kind of known to be one of the first activists to bridge this blue-green alliance, where she brought labor into the environmental fold, or vice versa. And the government was very, very concerned about this alliance, especially in the timber areas of Northern California. So as she grew in popularity, and as with Martin Luther King, when he became too popular and too effective, they did away with him. And in the early 1990s, the FBI decided that Judy Berry needed to be neutralized. So on May 24th, 1990, Judy and Daryl were on a roadshow going around California organizing for Redwood Summer, which they had called Mississippi Summer in the Redwoods, kind of as a, you know, thank you back to the civil rights era, ironically, when a motion-triggered pipe bomb wrapped with nails for shrapnel blew up directly under Judy's driver's seat of her car. The bombing caused devastating injuries that lasted the rest of her life. She actually ended up dying of cancer, but she had paralysis, and it just, you know, tore through her innards, basically. And she has two young daughters at that time. But immediately after that happened, the FBI and the Oakland police alerted the media that two nonviolent environmental activists were terrorists blown up by their own bomb. And so the cops and the media continued to collaborate and did a bunch of false leaks into the media. Everybody was soaking this up. But ultimately, the Alameda County DA never filed charges because there wasn't evidence against them. But the cops were doing no investigation at all, despite the fact that Judy had received death threats. They never even took fingerprints off the car or the bomb, which was quite unusual. And, of course, apparently that's because they were too busy trying to frame the activists. But Judy was a fighter, and she fought back, and they forced the FBI to turn over tons of documents and files. And ultimately, they filed a federal rights lawsuit against the FBI and the Oakland police, suing, and the claims were to suppress, that the feds were trying to suppress, chill, and neutralize their constitutionally protected activities in defense of the environment. 10 years later, and over 20,000 pages worth of evidence, including FBI files and agent testimony, they won that case. The FBI was held liable for bombing her, and she got $4.1 million as a result of it. In a moment of some eerie foreshadowing, over a decade before federal prosecutors conjured up the idea to call a cell of radical activists the family. If any of you followed the Oregon Green Scare cases, the feds were constantly trying to call this cell the family, even though none of them admitted that they ever called themselves that. But they probably got it from this article that happened 10 years earlier, which said, "Environmental activism is the new target of political suspicion and surveillance, and law enforcement agencies are stepping up action against those who demand radical change, calling them agitators, outsiders, the mafia, and extremists. Local, state, and federal investigators suspect them of violent acts or the potential for them." And they've responded over the last year with arrests, searches, raids, etc. So turning now to our modern era of COINTELPRO, we dubbed that era kind of the Green Scare going back to 2000 till the present. And the government has encapsulated this era in several ways. In 2002, James Jarboe, who's the domestic terrorist section chief of the FBI Counterterrorism Division, testified before the House Resources Committee that the ALF, the Animal Liberation Front, discourages acts that harm any animal, human and non-human. However, he did say they had emerged as a serious terrorist threat because of criminal action in the U.S. that resulted in $43 million of property damage. And then a couple years later, the Senate Environment Committee hearings on eco-terrorism happened. And in 2005, that committee held a bunch of hearings to examine the ELF and the ALF. They didn't have enough going on, I guess, in their own world, and they held this. So the first testimony at the hearing came from Senator James Inhofe, who's this crazy Republican from Oklahoma. He actually was one of the authors of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. He called the EPA, you know, we usually sue the EPA for not doing enough. He called them a Gestapo bureaucracy. And he has called the threat of catastrophic global warming the greatest hoax ever perpetuated on the American people. And so he called mainstream environmentalists, environmental extremists, alarmists, and fearmongers, and really started the drumbeat to go after the ELF and ALF, comparing them to Al-Qaeda. So in January of 2006 is when those Oregon indictments came down, charging people who had committed acts of economic sabotage, property damage. You know, arson is another word for it. But instead of just calling them those crimes, we had the former U.S. attorney going on national TV and calling them eco-terrorists. We also had the feds, for the first time in the history of the United States, seeking the terrorist enhancement on crimes that did not cause human death, never done before until that time. And this was all basically, you know, trying to discredit disrupt and put an end to this movement that was growing very, very fast. And don't forget, in the United States, the crime of arson carries about a 2-year prison sentence. These young people were facing life plus 1,115 years in some circumstances for the exact same crime. So we saw some very unusual disparate prosecutions going on. Eric McDavid, who some of you may have heard of, is currently sentenced to serve over 20 years for doing nothing but going along with a paid FBI infiltrator that slept with him and entrapped him into a conspiracy to build a bomb. No action actually occurred in that case at all, but this young anarchist has been convicted of a thought crime alone and is currently in prison for that. That takes us to November of 06, when conservatives sleazily passed a law that makes it a federal crime of terrorism to hinder the profits of an animal enterprise. And this was not only a direct attack against the growing popularity of the animal rights movement, but a little gift to their friends at the pharmaceutical and cosmetic corporations that profit off of that unspeakable torture of animals. But if you're just an environmentalist, don't take much rest in that, because the original versions of the law included environmental as well as animal enterprises, and many states now have passed these laws that are animal and environmental terrorism laws. The law was passed not to fight crime, because all of these things are already crimes. You know, arson, burglary, vandalism, they could have prosecuted them for those things, but clearly this was meant to just chill the rights of activists, lawful activists. So the first prosecution of the AETA was a bit of a shocker. The AETA 4, who are in California, are literally charged with picketing, holding signs, and using the internet to obtain publicly available information. Those are the allegations against them. And both are incontrovertible First Amendment activities. So we were pretty shocked that the poster children for the first AETA terrorist prosecutions were going to be lovely young activists who were holding signs and using the internet. We're still fighting motions in that case and getting discovery and stuff, but tomorrow night is a benefit for the AETA 4. They're very, very deserving of all of your support. And the case will be incredibly, incredibly important for the future of activism, whatever form it takes. Right now, they are arguing that home demonstrations, standing in front of places, holding signs and chanting, will no longer be a First Amendment protected activity. Hundreds of years our Constitution has been around, and this has always been tantamount to protected activity, and this will be an incredible rollback of everyone's First Amendment rights if we lose this case. The next case of terrorism was two young kids that were charged with a really small mink release in Utah. They let some furry creatures that were going to be slaughtered for jackets and coats, and apparently that's a terrorist act in the United States today. And interestingly there, one of the defendants accepted a negotiated non-cooperation plea deal, meaning he didn't have to snitch, he was just going to plead guilty. They worked out the years in jail. He goes in front of the judge in Utah. The judge refuses to accept the plea bargain because the punishment wasn't stiff enough for the terrorist standing in front of him. So he would not take the plea, and that case is currently in limbo. His co-defendant is set to go to trial in front of this same judge. And then we've got the AETA case in Iowa. This one is really interesting because literally it is a prosecution of anarchists. And people really should be paying attention to this. It's being prosecuted in Davenport, Iowa. The federal prosecutor, whose name is Clifford Cronk III, love that. He is using his investigation of a 2004 break-in by animal rights activists at the University of Iowa to harass and punish young people whom he claims identify as anarchists. In behavior very reminiscent of the darkest days of the McCarthy era, Cronk argued in filed court documents that anarchists are domestic terrorists who should be locked up for posing a threat to civil order, based on nothing but his say-so, apparently, and his very illiterate notions of what anarchism means. So just as McCarthy challenged accused communists to deny their associations with the Communist Party, Kronk has repeatedly argued that a person's failure to deny anarchist sympathies proves that he or she is one, and the affiliation is its own indictment. Okay, let me just read you DeMuth. Scott DeMuth is the person who's been indicted now. He's a 22-year-old sociologist. And he was indicted one day after the statute of limitations ran for a law that was not even passed at the time the crime happened. So there's all these legal reasons why he should not even be prosecuted at this point. But here's what the prosecutor said of why he should be. The defendant did not deny that he is an anarchist. This is what he said in open court. He did not deny involvement with ALF. The defendant's writings, literature, and conduct suggest that he is an anarchist and associated with the ALF movement. Therefore, he is a domestic terrorist. As such, he poses a serious risk of danger to those he opposes and to law enforcement, as well as a risk of flight to avoid prosecution. Carrie Feldman was his girlfriend at the time. She's 20 years old. She's being held in jail as we speak for grand jury non-cooperation, which Nadia will talk about more. And I just kind of wanted to quickly touch on a couple of techniques that the feds use, and then I will pass the mic. So the feds have always had this idea, nip it in the bud. You know, they want to crush a movement before it gets going. And so one of their big tactics is called neutralization. And according to the FBI, that doesn't necessarily pertain to arresting you in the commission of a crime, but really it is to make it so that you can no longer engage in political activity. You know, you're being watched so often that you can't even be a valuable resource to your community any longer. They've used GPS tracking devices, they spy on your email, phone calls, they've conducted sneak and peek searches pursuant to the Patriot Act, and most of this is just to intimidate, not because they actually think the person is going to lead them to a crime. And if you continue to be an activist in the face of this repression, both then and now, they ratchet their tactics up a notch as well. And as we've seen historically, the end of that game often has resulted in murders. I'm sure that both of these guys can speak to the number of murders that occurred within the Black Power and the Black Liberation movements because they would not back down in the face of government repression. There are things like the FBI has been notorious for deliberately creating and perpetuating factionalism, trying to divide movements, you know, this idea of direct action versus no direct action. You know, the feds love that stuff, you know, all these little infighting things between environmentalists and animal rights activists, whether you're underground or badass or black clad or whatever, that is traditional factionalism that the FBI uses to make us fight amongst ourselves instead of fighting our common enemy. And they plant stories and they plant distrust and all of these things. And they've done it for the last 40 years, effectively. And so you really need to be on the lookout for this stuff and make sure that when, you know, you think somebody's an informant, you know they are. Because snitch jacketing is another very common tactic where the FBI will purposely start rumors that someone is an infiltrator or an informant, maybe because they are a vibrant, up-and-coming activist or something along those lines. So, okay, I'll just skip to my conclusion. So we cannot, basically our movements can't afford to fail at this point. You know, the balance of ecological survival really kind of hangs in the balance for us, you know, and for our generations. So we can't let ourselves fall victim to this enemy again. We must learn from our predecessors. We have to work extremely hard to avoid government-induced implosion. We must be smart, thoughtful, and strategic. Our future hangs in the balance of either ecological revolution or government destruction. And through its actions, the U.S. government is fulfilling the radical words of former 1960s President John F. Kennedy, who said, "Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable." So global warming, poison water, poison air, Monsanto food, whether you're a gardener, a sign holder, a sea shepherd, an elf, or a lawyer, I hope you will continue to fight with both brains and bravery to make the world a better place for all of us to live, which is a very revolutionary concept indeed.